Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager, your host. Today's date is June 14, 2015, which is Flag Day in the United States. Ray Goodwin and I are going to continue with and conclude the reading and commentary of Adolf Hitler's private address to generals and high-ranking officers at the Plätterhof Hotel on May 26, 1944. The text translated into English by Carlos Whitlock Porter can be found at carolynyager.net under the title New Translation of Hitler's May 1944 Talk to Officers at the Plätterhof. Hello to you, Ray. How are you doing on this fine Flag Day Sunday?
Oh, fine, Carolyn. Looking forward to the program as usual.
Okay, well, we're going to be able to get it up online, I think, by tomorrow. But before we get started, I wanted to emphasize what I do think Hitler was trying to accomplish. And I think that we can see throughout this that he is trying to get them to see is the right way to go. That what he has done and everything that he's done has led to the progress. And here's the thing, when so many things that he goes into that I originally thought, well, that just came into his mind, so he just decided to say that. And he said things like this before, and so these are things that he talks about. But that I was totally wrong about that, because I could see after I read again more so carefully for this program and saw that in the second half how he was, particularly toward the end, he was bringing everything together, everything that he had discussed previously in this talk, and all the things that seemed to go off here and go off there, they all played a part in what he was, in his National Socialist German state. The main point that he makes is that the German people are so unified and working together as a whole, and in the second part he goes into that kind of thing quite a bit, how important it is to function as with one mind, and he describes the programs that he's put in place for that. It's quite impressive. He understands what he's trying to say all the way through this long talk. He's doing it out of his head, so it just shows how
That's
impressive
right.
he is as a thinker and how he can hold his attention on what his current concern is, what he's currently doing. And at the end, he pulls it all together. And he is basically telling them, in my opinion, that National Socialism is the highest and the best manifestation of the German nature and the German people.
Spirit.
And the German spirit, there you go. And it is the future. And it has been fully successful, and this is the direction we're going in, and everybody needs to get on board. Basically mm-hmm. telling those officers that if they're not on board with this, they should be, and why? He's not ordering them, we're not saying,
what?
You all better do this, but he's, as usual, using his powers of persuasion to convince mm-hmm. them, and that if they were all on board, that he is convinced that they will win. But not being all on board is the weakness. And he's trying to show them that. And he took his time and he went through everything. And then I also think, Ray, of how much energy it took to give this long talk.
Oh, yes.
And to have his goal in mind all the time. He must have been exhausted at the
yep.
end of it.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
I'll just let our listeners know that we wrapped up part one. Essentially, Hitler was talking about the difficulty in forming his party because, you know, trying to establish a new leadership principle based strictly on ability and not on where you were from, to whom you were born, things like this. And he said it's quite a difficult task. And that's where we left off with him speaking about that. And that's where we're going to be starting here on part two of his talk. The Führer is speaking. But first, of course, it's not a pretty picture, I admit it. At first, we had all sorts of difficulties, and you can really get some white hair before you've put everything back in order again. But I always counted on one thing. The time will come when that will all have been worth it. When you'll see that this selection process, which has been made one of the hard principles of the party, is correct. And really, that's the most basic thing. The most decisive. Since today, when we speak of a national community, you can only do so on the condition of suitable leadership and people. There are a lot of training courses being given today for officers in the so-called Hardenbergen not just because they're suited for it, but because that gives them an insight into the way we start out with our youth, building up their education. Of course, gentlemen, nothing is perfect. You ought not forget, we came to power in 1933. The war began in 1939, so we had barely 6 years. During the war, there's a limit to what we can do to continue building, but there's no doubt about it. When our people have had 50 years of peace, then we'll see something. The whole nation will be completely organized, and the leadership of the nation will consist of the best political leadership corps we've ever had, carefully selected from the best we've got. There's no doubt about that. Enthusiastic applause.
Yeah. Now, you know, I just wanted to mention, Ray, that the Ordenburgen were a series of fortresses built by the Teutonic Knights. And he's saying that they're using those structures to train these officers because they also have their own spirit, and that goes in with the spirit of what they're trying to do in building up the education of the German youth. And also, he said that the whole nation will be completely organized. And, you know, just it was yesterday or the day before, I was just happened to be come upon some photographs of Third Reich Germany. And as I started looking at them, these were some I had never seen before, but, you know, nothing out of the ordinary. But just seeing how the nation was, throughout the entire German Reich, there were banners, swastika flags flying, and images and eagles and all the different things that, and of course they weren't everywhere, but, you know, in these photographs it made it appear that that wherever you went, it was the same spirit going on. And you might think when you say that this nation would be completely organized, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, isn't there any room for an individual doing their own thing? But these images gave me the sense so strongly that this was such a special time. Instead of feeling sad about it, I was feeling like happy that it ever took place. You know, that's a different feeling for me. In looking at these, it was like, boy, this was just such a magical time, something that had never really been done in this way, and it's a tremendous accomplishment.
Yes, you called it right, magical time, because, and we got to be kin to one another, because that's exactly how it affects me. When I see those old pictures of the Reich and the people and the villages and the how things, there's just an element of good feeling and positive there, and you can see the smiles on the people's faces, and they're a happy lot, and it does things for me too. It's very much a positive, uplifting thing to look at those pictures. Fuhrer goes on, and of course, gentlemen, it'll be not only a selection of the best speaking talent, but rather the bravest leadership elements. We're looking for these young people today, not just from the point of view of intellectual gifts, the way they did before. That's why so many talented people ended up wearing a dunce cap. The teachers revenged themselves by saying, "That's your punishment, the dunce cap," when the talent was too much for the teacher. Gentlemen, it's not just purely a matter of intellectual talent, scholarship, but character. We're examining these boys, their character, reactions, hardness, leadership ability, the so-called ringleader ability, which they already possess as youngsters. That must be evaluated in addition to their intellectual abilities. Sometimes you can tell yourself when you look at a kid, a very talented boy, but he'd rather be boxing or something, or gymnastics, but he's really bad at everything else. Before, about 30 years ago, that was enough. If you flunked one required subject, you failed. Today, we settle matters differently. On the musical side, we go so far that a musically talented kid is sent to music school even if he flunks maths, is completely hopeless in French and geometry and chemistry, but he's musically gifted and enthusiastic, so he goes to music school, since he's not supposed to be a mathematician or a surveyor, but rather a musician. And that's enough. All the rest of it is mostly forgotten in later life, and he'll never need it in his career, and he'll forget 9/10 of it. He'll only remember what he learns in primary school and general education. So, we're looking for abilities without regard to birth or origins. And believe me, first of all, we eliminate the whole social question for two reasons. First, we're building a people's community, the leadership of which will be largely derived from the people themselves. That is, an elementary knowledge of all things that move the people. In constantly allowing blood from below to come flowing through, I'm doing what the Catholic Church did through the circuitous route of celibacy. Since the priests can't have children, they were compelled to take their individual priests out of the people. That is why there are priests from families of lower-ranking officials, small businessmen, former farm boys, etc. This accounts for the strength of the allegedly disputatious church. I'm doing exactly the same thing, taking the offspring of the entire people, not just on the way to celibacy. I can't use that. Shouts of approval and merriment. The entire people is sifted through, and I gradually get a class of people in the leadership of the nation who more or less know all the problems of life, from their own youth, from their own relatives, their parents, their brothers and sisters, etc., the environment. But they also elevate themselves, more and more, especially my Galiter, who are so wonderfully gifted in a practical sense, who have an exact knowledge of everything, so that it's a matter of course for them to solve the problems that arise due to the very nature of people. All these Galiters, Christliters, and Ortsgruppenleiter, etc., can do this, as easy as pie. You've seen this over and over. So I solved the social question by bringing a broadly anchored element into the leadership. Second, however, I solve it by forming this leadership class out of the best, most energetic, thereby depriving the broad masses of the possible starting point for a counter-revolution ahead of time, particularly, however, by helping them to see that this state is not a class state.
Yeah, well, so he's were you going to say something?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you did that, because I was going to stop right there, because that's a very, very powerful paragraph. Mm-hmm. And he tells you this is how you defeat Bolshevism, really, you know, is to make all of the people feel like that they have an investment in the state, that they have a part of the state, that is their state. And by doing away with this class state, he can do that.
Yeah, he doesn't want these dissatisfied people lurking around out there.
That's
particularly
right.
If they're the gifted people. If they are the people who have that gift of leadership, then they start a counter-revolution. And He's actually talking about preventing counter-revolution. And he mentions it again some more later. He speaks about everything, how to keep his state unified and together and not allowing problems to start and counter forces to take a hold of things.
Yeah, he knows, he's well aware, of course, that within the masses, the more voices in there, in the masses that are saying, things should be better than this, things can be better than this, then there's your stirring point right there. And when you take leadership from through the broad masses and everything, you quell those voices about things could be better than this, because they can be countered by saying, how?
And then he goes and he finds those people, and if they're not too far gone, he brings them into his programs and lets them take charge and try to make things better. That's what he says he's doing. He's looking for those people. If they're too far gone, then they put them in prison camp or something. But if they're not, then they try to say, hey, well, if you want to make things different here, let's see how you can help do that.
The Fuhrer continues. Because believe me that the purely theoretical is often more important than the so-called actual, which might be starting to make its appearance among us Germans. Don't forget, we Germans are so mad about principles that we fought the 30 Years' War just over the question of whether we should take the Eucharist in one or two forms, and a few similarly important things. Among Germans, it's not a matter of indifference for people to get the impression that the leadership class is being formed out of the entire people. It's important for the women and mothers, since it's something wonderful for every mother to know that she can perhaps have a child who can rise to a high position in the state. And if we're only fair, and the positive services, not the political services, which in the past have been mostly much worse than among other countries, if we just imagine these services, which really require the entire life of the people, that is, the cultural life, the social, real achievements of a nation, the intellectual achievements, when we just think of that and recognize that all these things are just the products of individual men, And if we could make these men parade before us out of the gray mists of the past, all the innumerable inventors, discoverers, scientific pioneers, engineers, technicians, and chemists, etc., as well as the great artists, musicians, from among our people, and God knows what all else, to whom we owe everything, to whom we owe our cultural life, whom we thank for giving us our language, so that we Germans can look at ourselves with pride as Germans. If we could just make them appear before us, and imagine their mothers here with us, next to them, like a stroke of magic, then you'd suddenly see what kind of lowly little women they were. Peasant women, working men's wives, the wives of small artisans, etc. And what became of the sons of these women? It's a tremendous reconciliation in a people when they know that the differences in ability exist after all, but that the differences administratively will not remain forever. If we at least convince the people as to the common good of a people, that when some child is found, wherever he comes from, who has the ability, then we'll take him under our wing immediately and provide him with everything he needs, instead of making all kinds of problems for him because of his birth. Rather, on the contrary, we're going to help him overcome these problems for the good of the state. And it says thunderous applause.
I just think we need to comment just for a moment how he's saying here that he's talking about the mothers. And there's no mothers in this audience, you know, that he's speaking with.
That's
but
right.
He's talking about how important it is in the state that he's built up here for the women and the mothers to know that their children can achieve the highest. You know, in the United States, we're always saying that anybody can grow up to become president of the United States, you know, such a free mm-hmm. country and so on. But it's not really as true in the United States even at any point of time as it was in National Socialist Germany that everybody had a chance to move up to the highest.
Sure. And he demonstrates so well, so perfectly, the value of these little old women that nobody would ever have noticed. And I thought it was a great lesson to, you know, to teach that, hey, everybody is of tremendous value in this National Socialist state, because you never know who's going to produce the next Beethoven or, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. see?
Yes, and, so you know, he was also thinking of his own mother.
Oh, yeah.
That
mm-hmm.
his mother was such a humble woman and wasn't even at all brilliant or anything. It was kind of simple, maybe, in her thinking.
Right.
And very
that's
pious
right.
and went to mass every day and so on. But look what she brought forth into the world. The Führer,
right.
you know, him, and he knew he was a great man. He knew that.
Mm-hmm.
He knew his place in history. So that plays a part in him coming up with this particular kind of analogy.
Yes, I do too. Very good. Anyway, he was just talking about the child being taken under the wing of the state and his talents nourished and fed and brought to the surface. And now, the Führer continues, that will eliminate the last vestiges of the Marxist theory of class hatred. And this conviction, which already exists among the broad masses of the German people, gentlemen, we're grateful for it. And to you, all of us, that today millions of German workers, even old men, go to the factories and work there, which many of them refused to do in 1917. If they do that today, in the conviction that they are fighting for their state, that it is their state, although they are just simple workers, but they are convinced that they possess an equality of rights in the state, that they enjoy complete equality of rights, an immeasurable strength comes of this, and they are convinced that this state, if it continues to develop like this, will take care of them, their children, and that everybody will be correctly treated according to his abilities. At the same time, and I really have to say this, I've carried out this entire process without hurting other people or doing them wrong. Of course you can do something like this by first smashing everything to pieces and exterminating everybody. I haven't done that, since I believe in the principle of selection, which is of course a principle tried and tested in the past. I know that everybody in the leadership classes today is already the product of just such a selection process. Since I also believe in heredity, this also produces a constant hereditary stream of new people. I didn't want to eliminate the good, the old, in order to favor something different, but rather I wanted to keep the good and the old and gradually introduce something different. Of course, this is not easy. It would have been far easier for me simply to exterminate the entire old leadership classes, let's say, the way the Bolsheviks did, and then begin a process of reconstruction. But then the equalization possibilities would not have existed, which so often act as obstruction today. The war has had a colossally educational effect here, too, I've got to say that. Without the First World War, I would never have become a National Socialist. But the war had an endless educational impact, even without everything else.
Okay, let me say here, I would like to point out that here he's answering those people who say he didn't carry out his revolution mm-hmm. as he promised to do in the beginning. He stopped partway, and then he made peace with the industrialists and with the wealthy class and with the military class and so on. And, you know, he didn't continue that, and that was the problem. But he's explaining why, and it's always stood. I mean, I've never questioned it, but it's always been obvious that he wanted to bring all the people together, and he calls it an equalization mm-hmm. process here, the possibilities for equalization, so that it would be possible to have in this nation what he was talking about earlier, where everybody had a chance at getting ahead, and you were looking mm-hmm. for the people that were most gifted and had the best leadership abilities for these positions. That's kind of like a debate that's ongoing, whether Hitler missed the boat there because he didn't carry out a really tough, hard revolution of the people, and the people, the leftists kind of think that that's what he should have done, and instead he compromised.
Well, I was just going to say that's what differentiated his movement from Jewish communism. That's what made possible the unification of the people and took out that stratified layer of society, if you want to call it that, to where you have an elite and all the way down to the bottom of the proletariat, as the communists call them. You don't have that with National Socialism. And if he had taken the smash mouth, as he just discussed, approach, tore everything to bits and started a brand new, he was going to lose something by doing mm-hmm. that, because there were some value in the
oh, absolutely.
and everything. And so he says, I wanted to incorporate both. I wanted to take this, the old, put it in together with ours and eventually bring everything forward to this point. That is the differentiation of National Socialism, particularly from Marxism or Bolshevism. And I think that's exactly why it was successful, as thoroughly successful as it was, because it didn't take that approach of the left saying, well, he's going to discuss it in the next paragraph. You know, hey, why do we have to be with these people, these capitalists?
Right. I just thought that even with the Nuremberg laws, he mm-hmm. brought them out over the course of several years. He started out with a couple of the most important, about marriage, I think, and then they went on to some more and some more over about 5-6 years time. He didn't just come out all at mm-hmm. once and make all these laws for people to have to follow that were new for them.
You know? Right. Okay, continuing. There were a lot of people who said, you know, National Socialism is all very well, but when I imagine that I might one day have the honor to sit next to such a proletarian, you've got to understand what's right. But in the end, illegible. And what do I do then? I'm keen on the people, of course. I want to be our own people of brothers, but naturally with some distance between us, with some reservation, sir. There are limits to everything. We shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And on the other side, they were saying the same thing. They said, what? We're supposed to sit next to this stuffed shirt and these capitalists? Not on your life. We're proletarians. We have our class consciousness. They were obsessed with class consciousness on the one hand and their pride of place on the other hand. And sometimes these prejudices are stronger than the thickest concrete walls we're building today.
Yeah, he's trying to get across to how difficult it was to mm-hmm. actually do this, because people didn't even want to think of other sections of
yes.
the country as being anything like themselves.
Mm-hmm. That's true. It says laughter and enthusiastic approval. Nevertheless, we've gradually succeeded in pushing back class prejudice. And despite the talk on both sides, we've succeeded in building up the party with many setbacks. And that, gentlemen, is how we built up our resistance to crises. You've got no idea how many setbacks I've had in my life. What we've suffered in military defeats serves for me to recognize mistakes, organize better, and do better. That's nothing compared to what I've suffered in setbacks in my life in building up the party. Do not say, but that was less important. Gentlemen, it was my life and my conviction, and Germany depended on it, exactly the way it depends on the outcome of this war today. And if we hadn't succeeded in building it up, then sooner or later, the Bolshevik hordes would have overwhelmed Europe. That the Poles would ever have restrained themselves and all the rest of it, nobody believes that today, with what we now know. And the struggle before 1933 was a struggle for life or death.
Well, what do you think he means here then when he says that the Poles would ever have restrained themselves? Well, I think he's saying that he had to do what he did. You know, there were some in the military who did not want the invasion of Poland. They didn't. And probably they still had the same feelings. They still were against everything from the beginning. They didn't like the war. So he's saying here that they would not have been able to prevent further damage being done by the Bolsheviks and by the Poles.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the main causes of action in September of 1939 was the way the Poles were murdering, slaughtering, and doing everything else to the German people who were in East Prussia. And he says that these Poles would ever have restrained themselves. No. I mean, they wouldn't. They had shown they wouldn't.
Well, he says nobody believes that today. So
that's right.
Information had come out and diplomatic papers and lots of stuff had come out
in
the meantime that we're aware of. And then he says that this, he goes before 1933. He says before 1933, before he came to power, it was already a struggle for life or death.
Sure. And at that time, we were convinced that all these setbacks could be overcome, because in a crisis situation like this, according to historical experience, you've always got to expect setbacks. Just name me one great process in history that never suffered any setbacks. It doesn't exist. Every state, which has just made a fantastic advance, will be faced with frequent crises. Yes, I say, great men are only tested in crises. There's no great man that hasn't overcome a crisis. You can believe that. What especially great and admirable men in German history mean to us is that they are the men who constantly had to fight in great crises. Whether it's a Martin Luther, or out of recent history, I don't know, Frederick the Great or Richard Wagner, in quite another field. I've picked three different fields. They're all just men who constantly had to overcome some catastrophe, and in the end, with their stubbornness and their tenacity, who achieved their goals and fought their way through.
Now that's a good, those are some good comparisons he's making
to point out why they need
to keep their stubbornness and their tenacity. Yeah.
But there was another problem that had to be solved at that time if the German nation was ever to rise again. It was not only a question of the order of the social body, but above all, the mobilization of the intellectual elements who were already available in the time before I came along as motive power, men who were capable of moving other men to the ultimate. There were two main points of view. On the one hand, there was the nationalist ideal, which was vague and defined in various ways, but anyway, it was a force for which 100 men volunteered in 1918. Men who were willing to fight and give their lives. And you can't ask for more idealism from a man than to be ready even to risk his life if necessary. But on the other side of the barricades, there were idealists too. They were the communists who believed they were fighting for a communist ideal. Basically, at that time, there were two phenomena fighting with each other. On the one side, a nationalist, a poor devil, and his officer, who was a poor devil too. And on the other side, the communist, or Spartacist, or USPD man, and so on, also a poor devil. It wasn't the so-called upper classes of satisfied capitalists who were fighting at that time, and naturally the Jewish leaders of the Marxists weren't fighting either. At that time, it was a matter of course from the very start that this new movement, which could have called itself by quite another name, had to take account of these two existing elements. One could not say, let's ignore them, or we refuse to have anything to do with them. but rather one had to acknowledge that these were forces to be reckoned with. The definitions of these two concepts were diametrically opposed to each other at that time. The one was on the right side of the barricade, and the other was on the left. And I climbed up on the barricade in between them, and was naturally shot at by both sides. I attempted to define this new concept with the motto that nationalism and socialism are the same in the end, namely that the people are at the center of everything worthwhile, that is, not any particularly class interest as antithesis, but rather the people at the center of everything worthwhile, because socialism is nothing more than the struggle for this people as a whole, and nationalism is the same thing.
Well, that's quite important, isn't it?
It's a great definition, gosh, I wish a lot of people would read that today and know about it, because just any the words, if anything's got the word socialism in it, oh, the middle class and the big boys react with such horror. Why, you red rascal, you know, you communist son of a gun. I mean, that's their lack of understanding, and that was such a wonderful definition.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and he says up a few paragraphs above when he starts out on this, these intellectual elements, the nationalist and the more communist type things, were already available in the time before I came along. So he's saying that all this, he's admitting, which he, of course, is true, that all this nationalism preceded him. But what, as he goes on then, he takes credit for putting nationalism together with socialism, which puts the people in the center and having a party for the good of the people and the good of the whole. That's how he's describing it here. By himself.
Oh, yeah. And actually, Carolyn, this very next paragraph hits exactly what we just said. The Fuhrer says, I had serious fights with both the right and the left at that time. The left declared, it's impossible. We cannot go with the nationalists, because they understood nationalism to mean the bourgeoisie, and vice versa, the bourgeoisie rejected socialism because they understood socialism to mean Marxism. That is, internationalism.
He's pointing out to these officers, who he's trying to convince to go along with his National Socialist worldview, that this is something that he accomplished which has brought the German people to a unified, they might not be perfectly unified, but they're certainly functioning as one in this time of war crises. And they're doing a very good job, and he's pointing out to them that this was his program, that he gets credit for that, and he's part of his persuasion tactics. Now, the next line is the one that I want to bring out that has been mistranslated by Veronica Clark in her book, in her two books, actually.
Good.
Since it's a longer paragraph, I'll just say he starts out by saying, but one thing was clear, people and people are not the same. And in the German, I can't read the German very well, but aber eins war ja doch nun klar, and then Volk und Volk ist nicht dasselbe. So he says Volk und Volk, people and people. And yet in the Clark translation, it is changed too. But now it is clear, nevertheless, race and people are not the same.
Goodness.
And so there's no reason to change that, because it's perfectly clear that it says Volk und Volk. But, of course, earlier we had the paragraphs about the difference between a people and a race. And we know that Hitler's made it clear, in his opinion, that a people is not a race. A people is like a nation or a Volk.
Right.
Volk, nation, people, all the same. Race, something else. So, obviously, there was some reason that she wanted to bring out again that Hitler is saying that race and people are not the same. Whereas, he said it earlier, so there's no need to do it, but he didn't say it here. He was talking about something else. See, now, I brought this out, if you recall, a year ago, maybe. Been no answer from Miss Clark about that. She's never responded to what I've brought out here. At least it's been 6 months ago. But you go ahead and read that paragraph now, and we'll see why it has nothing to do with race.
Right. But one thing was clear. People and people are not the same. Now, what's bracketed here, Carolyn, I think is quite important, because it's very definitive. It says, i.e., nationalism and socialism did not imagine themselves as representing the same people. Yeah, that's very good.
Well, and socialism should really be communism. So nationalists and communists did not imagine themselves as representing the same people.
And he goes on to say, I can imagine a people with a thin ruling class and a perfectly miserable mass of poor folk, squalid, louse-ridden, filthy, but raised to blind obedience, who simply follow. I can imagine that. This idea awakens no satisfaction in me. I find it horrible. What I believe is the first, most worthwhile idea to have to see is a people who look healthy. Because I won't be able to represent for long a governmental interest in the former people. One day it will disintegrate when a catalyst comes along, suddenly uniting and mobilizing this left-wing mass. And that catalyst is the foreign body of Judaism. So I must draw upon another concept of the people as the ideal.
I think this is his first mention of Jews in this talk, is it?
Yeah, I think
and
so
he
too.
He brings it up. It's really important here. He's calling it a foreign body. And again, this emphasizes his belief that the German people are one. They're a unit. It doesn't matter what kind of racial elements make it up. They have become, over time, all German. And the state that they're in now, state of Germanness that they're in now, is what he sees as the norm. He's not saying that it could still be changed, that you could still bring other elements in, and he doesn't agree with that. He thinks it is fixed as it is pretty much, and this is the German people. And everything else is a foreign body, and he's calling Judaism a foreign body.
Right, right. What he's saying is that in the past there, it was so vulnerable because he said, I can imagine a country or with a thin elite, and then you got a broad mass of the people who miserable, but they were raised to a blind obedience who simply just follow. He said, I can imagine that. But what he's telling you, this is a ticking time bomb, and it wouldn't take long for a foreign mass to come into it to mobilize this left-wing mass. And that catalyst is the foreign body of Judaism, which the Jews were behind, of course, the communist revolution trying to overthrow Germany.
Right.
And I think that he is referring back to.
You're right.
He says, so I must draw up another concept of the people as the ideal. And this can only come through when I set up a body of the people as the ideal of the future, in which there is actually the highest degree of education, of culture, of living standards. And when one first recognizes this ideal, that it is just as beautiful, believe me, to care for a people as it is for a brave company leader to care for his men, he too gradually starts to see this, what he's there for. In his men, he doesn't see something he doesn't care about, something he only needs, but rather he sees his own fulfillment in them. He cares about his last man and takes care of him. And the more he does this, the more satisfied his men will be, but also the more satisfied he'll be himself one day and better able to appreciate them. This applies in the same way for the entire population generally.
As the National Socialist Führer, or whoever would become the National Socialist Führer in the future, will care about his people and look after them, and he's comparing that to the officer caring about his
men, right,
looking after his men.
That's right.
And the officers, I think, are really appreciating this, too.
I do, too. He continues, my movement set this goal for itself from the very beginning of overcoming the former class structure. I must admit now that it was easy in one area. In the German people, we had about 800,000 Jews, over a million, including the Ostmark and the Sudetenland. They were a foreign body in the body of our people who had deliberately occupied all key positions. And when these positions were occupied, necessarily and immediately moved countless others into that same category. Some people have not understood why I proceeded so brutally and ruthlessly here. And, of course, the class that should have been the most grateful to me for it didn't understand it at all. Because if I hadn't done it, then I would have had to intervene in the positions occupied by the members of older lifetime positions, positions which they had also occupied, partly based on natural selection and partly out of protection in order to build up a uniform body of the people.
So here he's saying that he's going further on how he's taking care of the people, saying that by removing the Jews from these positions, he was looking after the German people so that they will have the opportunity to have these positions. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he points out that once a Jew gets into one of these positions in the past, that he then made sure that all other positions that he had any influence on were also occupied by Jews. And we know how that works.
That's right.
I mean, we all know how that works.
And an interesting line, too, Carolyn, where he says, the class that should have been most grateful to me for it didn't understand it at all. Now, of course, that would be the bourgeoisie or the ruling, structure there.
Because they would be the ones who would be in those positions.
Yeah, and if the Jewish revolution succeeded with that lower masses, it would be the ones above them that's going to be slaughtered and going to have to pay the price of a communist revolution. And when Hitler says, I nipped this in the bud by removing these Jews of their positions of influence and in our society.
Well, I think he's just talking about work for the people, and that have Germans in all these positions and not have foreigners. Not have a foreign, foreign element of Jews.
Right. He says, I forced the Jews out of their positions and did so ruthlessly, of course. I didn't do it cruelly, like nature, but rather rationally, and in order to retain the best. And now I had hundreds of thousands of positions. I was able to place many tens of thousands of capable children of the people in these positions. I released innumerable peat bog digging college students from their fate and was able to put them in these positions. But I also made it possible for hundreds of thousands of proletarians and peasant children to grow into these positions in the future, which would otherwise have been claimed by Jews, a foreign body. Enthusiastic applause.
You know, I think it's important to point out that he is saying that he forced them out. He did it ruthlessly. That is, meaning he wasn't going to listen to complaints or whatever. But he didn't do it cruelly. He said, like nature would have done it.
Right.
He says, but rationally, in order to retain the best. And I thought, well, who is the best? What's he talking about? Well, he has to be talking about the best of the Jews, do you think? So he didn't get rid of all Jews, but the best ones he allowed to remain. Well, that was only a small amount, though. And all the rest he got rid of. And then he said that he filled these jobs with children of the people. And that's what he called it, you know, children of the people, not children of foreigners. So on. Further on, he called them proletarians and peasant children who could grow into these positions too. All these ones who didn't have any opportunities for anything now had an opportunity that possibly they could, if they were qualified, they could fill these positions. So he was doing all this. This is his taking care of the German people. And if you're going to take care of your own people, you can't at the same time be taking care of another people like the Jews were being taken care of. In Germany and elsewhere all over the world today.
Very true. After enthusiastic applause, it says, but that is also an advantage, gentlemen, since I've eliminated the last catalyst from among the masses, as I already stressed. In eliminating the Jews, I eliminated the possibility of the formation of any nucleus of revolution among the masses. Of course, people can always say, couldn't you have done it more simply or not more simply, since everything would have been more complicated, but more humanely? Gentlemen, officers, we are engaged in a struggle for life and death. If our enemies succeed in this struggle, the German people would be exterminated. Bolshevism would have slaughtered millions and millions of our intellectuals. Anybody who wasn't killed with a bullet in the back of the neck would be deported. The children of upper-class people would be taken away and eliminated. This whole bestiality is organized by Jews. Today, incendiary bombs and other bombs are being dropped on our cities, although the enemy knows that they can only hit women and children. They machine gun quite ordinary passenger trains and farmers in their fields. In one night, in a city like Hamburg, we lost over 40,000 women and children who burned alive. Do you expect anything different from me than to protect our national interests ruthlessly, since I believe that this is the way to achieve the most effective and greatest benefits for the German nation? Lengthy, enthusiastic applause. Acting humanely under such circumstances would be the greatest cruelty towards our own people. If I draw the hatred of the Jews upon me, then I would at least like to derive some benefit from that.
That's quite a statement. Then here, then I spoke too soon, Ray, because you were going to say shouts.
Yeah, shouts, quite correct.
So now these listeners are starting to participate a little bit more. They're getting worked up.
That's right.
And they're starting to say something back, but not actually, you know, interrupting him, but just saying things like this. This is what he was saying here that you just read, the previous paragraph, was what you were talking about a little earlier.
Yes,
that what
right.
the final end result of having these Jews in the country would be, which is
right.
the death and destruction of the German nation altogether. Again, Hitler was always so very clear about what the enemy's intentions were, wasn't he? Whereas other people were trying to believe that there were some ways out of it, some ways to find agreement. And then when he says, oh, it's so powerful to me, when he says, if I draw the hatred of the Jews upon me, I would at least like to derive some benefit from that hatred. He knew how much they hated him. And when you know you're so hated by a powerful group like those Jews, and yet you go ahead and do what you know is right, what you want to do, that's courage. That's real courage.
That is. That sets them apart.
I think so. They did, and we know that. It's still lasting today.
Sure. After the shouts of quite correct, the Fuhrer says, the advantage is that we now possess a cleanly organized body of the people in which no outsider can any longer just talk his way in. On the other hand, look at the other states. We've had an insight into another state that went the opposite way, Hungary. The whole state decomposed and eaten up, Jews everywhere, in all positions, right up to the very highest ones, more and more Jews. The whole state is covered by a gapless network of agents and spies who were just waiting. And the only reason they never struck was that they were afraid that if they struck too early, they would involve us. But they were waiting for the moment to strike. I intervened here as well. And this problem has now been solved, too, and I must say anyway, the Jew has made the extermination of the German people its program. As I declared in the German Reichstag on 1st September 1939, if anybody believes that such a world war would exterminate the German people, he's wrong. If Jewry really arranges it, world war, then the one that will be exterminated will be Jewry. Enthusiastic applause.
Yeah. When he says that in Hungary, it was Jews everywhere and it was the whole state was a big mess. He says, I intervened here as well. Well, this is May 1944. So this is where he convinced them that to allow him to move the Jews out of there and so this was the beginning of what's called the program to move all these Jews, 400,000, whatever, to Auschwitz and put them in gas chambers, which didn't happen, but he did intervene, and he did get them to allow him to take a lot of these Hungarian Jews and send them out to various and different work camps, which is where they all ended up, and in a lot of different places. That's what he's referring to there. And then it comes up this word exterminate. The word is ausrotten, or ausgerottet, and there's different varieties of it. But there's been a lot of studies about what that word really means, and exterminate is not the best choice for it. It is to, you know, clear out or get rid of.
Right.
Just thought I'd throw that in there.
That's good. With this policy, we took perhaps the greatest step in the...
I think when he says with this policy, he means his Jewish policy. The Jewish policy,
yes,
and it's
that's
important
right.
to know that he is saying
exactly
that this
right.
policy that has been so criticized, he says we took the greatest step in the inner order. It was one of the most important things that we did. We knew we had to do it, and we did it.
Sure. And he says, everything else in innumerable areas is now connected to it. And here I'd like to return to the starting point of my remarks, namely to the concept of worldview. I said that worldview is nothing more than the consideration of the entire world and its phenomena from a uniform standpoint of the latest scientific discoveries, serious discoveries. And I went after all other problems in the same way. We solved our economic questions, gentlemen, when all the so-called experts claimed they couldn't be solved. We solved our cultural problems. What didn't they say earlier? They said, what? You want to eliminate the Jews? Ha ha. Then you won't have any more money. You won't have any more gold. As if the Jews were a gold-producing element. Gold only has any meaning when it represents value. Values are not created by Jews, but rather by people who have invented valuable things or produce them. The Jew simply inserts himself between the inventor or producer and the consumer. He's a valve that restricts the flow. I built a valve which can cut off the flow when needed or let it flow again at
will.
You
know what kind of that, what that would be, that valve? You know, I understand that the Jew is the middleman and he can get in there and he, you know, gets in between the producer and the consumer. But then Hitler says that he built a valve which can cut off the flow or let it flow again at will. What is that?
Right. To me, it's the German money supply. It's the control of the nation's money back into the hands of the German.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it could be, though. It certainly has to do with money. It could be the way that they deal with the money in the Reichsbank or whatever it was. How that is done,
yeah.
But that's no doubt what he's referring to, yeah.
When I was young, I often went to the German Museum in Munich. That was the first great technical museum at that time. I had a tremendous interest in it. Almost the entire inventiveness of the human race is represented there. What was ever invented by Jews? The Jews who rule everything, the whole economic system, our industrial life, they rule everything. What did they ever invent? Where are the Jewish inventors? There's not a single one there. Not one. You can raise the same question in cultural life. People have said to me, so, when you kick out the Jews, you can say goodbye to the theater. But who really founded our culture? Was it the Jews? Who were our Jewish composers? Who were our great poets? Were our great thinkers, illegible, Jews, perhaps? How do the Jews suddenly succeed in inserting themselves into the production of the same goods that were created by the greatest Germans, or the discoveries that originated with the greatest Germans? Experiment showed that I was right. I removed the Jews. German theaters are full as never before. German film is flowering as never before. German literature, the German press, is being read as never before. Better than ever before. Much better. We swept away vulgarities in innumerable fields without ever falling victim to a prudery of the past. Since here we know a principle, namely, the maintenance of our race, our species. Everything that serves this principle is correct. Everything that detracts from it is wrong.
Well.
Enthusiastic applause about that, and I can certainly believe that.
Yeah, so he's making it very clear. The principle of his party, of his program, is the maintenance of our race, our species. So,
that's right. And Jewish immorality in film and entertainment is doing damage to that race. So, I mean, to me, that's what he was talking about there, their influence in the film industry, and he cleaned it up, pornography, things like this, which was a Jewish enterprise. But anyway, that's what I got from that when I first read it. So, naturally, we took many steps in many areas which were revolutionary and which were not understood at first. Even with the best will in the world by those who never studied this whole movement from the ground up, according to their scholarly points of view. Because we often stumble over old traditions, old moral concepts, etc., it's often forgotten that these moral concepts are just lies anyway because they don't even exist among the people. The people think quite differently about it. What didn't we have to clear away here? But gentlemen, Every such process in a great body of people or large-scale organization of a people's community must always proceed, regardless of tradition, always. I would like to come back to the military field, the rise of Prussia. I'll begin with the nucleus of our present German Reich. Was, after all, in the end, a process of gradually eliminating the innumerable traditions of other smaller states. This was always painful. The rise of the German Reich, first as the North German Bund, and later as the German Reich, was again an attack against innumerable traditions. Believe me, it was not easy for a state like Bavaria to do without many things associated, in their eyes, with the history of Bavaria. But it was no easier earlier for the Hanoverians, and no easier for the Saxons, no easier for the Württembergers, no easier for the Austrians. Austria had been a part of a great empire, and its 9 million Germans had a total of 56 million other peoples under their administration. Giving up one's self-sufficiency is painful. But where would they be now if the unified state had not been built
up? Well, he's talking about how difficult it is for any what was once an independent unit to give up its independence and join in to be just a part of a larger unit. And, of course, he's discussed this many times.
Right.
And talked about, mentioned also Bavaria. He always mentions Bavaria, that when they joined the Reich, they were an independent state. They had to give up a lot of things that they
had. That's right.
So it's not easy. It's not easy to build up.
That's right. That's right. Very fractured. And everybody had to sacrifice for the good of the whole. And that was an extremely difficult concept to try to put over.
Yeah, when they had been an independent entity.
Yes. Yeah. Now, I've always stressed that this isn't being carried out in a spirit of contempt for individual performance. One day, when a great soldier's hall is built in Berlin, it will be there to immortalize all the great German generals of our history. And I'll have them all immortalized there, quite regardless of where they may have fought in their lives. It will include Frederick the Great. It will have his generals in it. And on the other hand, it will also include a Daun, Austrian field marshal, a Laudon, also Austrian, one of Frederick's greatest enemies. It will include the enemies of German history from former centuries. Finally, all gathered together in brotherhood, our Reich, let's be proud of it, unites the traditions of all the individual states of the past and all individual German tribes. And the great Reichshall in Berlin will also contain funereal monuments to all great German heroes from the past to the present, and they will all lie together as brothers, regardless of which tribe they may have belonged to, if they simply deserve to be kept alive in our memory. That means this state will care for the memory of the whole many states of our German history, and that is a necessity. It will eliminate many painful things in particular, and that is a necessity.
Well, he's really looking to the future here. He's trying to
That's
show
exactly
them,
right,
you know,
yeah.
that, for well, for one thing, that he has respect for the military and he's going to create this big soldiers hall, which is something they would appreciate. But also that that the future of Germany is out there, and there's so much that can be done. He wants to inspire them, I think, to see a future, not to say, well, it's all over, and let's try to figure out how to get out of this the best way we can.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Nor have I, gentlemen, used the year 1933 as year one of German history. A lot of people have said to me, why don't you say year number one, year number two? The English would have loved that with their megalomania. When people ask me that, I say, I don't know exactly. At the latest, the Battle of Teutoburg Forest, probably, but even after a few battles of Teutons and Cimbri, why not them too? When I include German history in this great framework, and when I include the current state as the perfection, I would like to say, after a long process of military and political German activity, then I have the right to unite everything in this state which has been of service in the past. And then those ridiculous Englishmen come along and confront us. Let them come along with their ridiculous history of English kings. Then I'll show them the history of the German Reich. Then I'll be able to tell them, at a time when the English possessed a ridiculous little island, the German Kaisers rode thousands and thousands of kilometers representing the German Reich. Or enthusiastic applause. What was England then? A ludicrous little enclave of Teutons, that's all. German history doesn't begin with us, the German Revolution, but will rather be perfected with us. This so-called German Third Reich will bring to perfection that which was only attempted in the First Reich, that which was unfortunately overlooked in parts by the Second Reich, but which will finally find fulfillment in this Third Reich. That is the aim of this state. To this end, we founded this gigantic people's organization, and with the party as the model and leaven of this organization, of the body of our people. And right now, I would like to answer an objection that has often been raised. Why do you still keep the party as a small body within the German people? I've already said, because the German people, taken as a whole, are not capable of leadership. The party built itself up in struggle. Only people who wanted to fight, and now we're doing it. After all, I didn't have to invent communists artificially just to have somebody to fight against. The German youth, you must have noticed, is being educated in bravery and absolute commitment. Because it's crazy to imagine that bravery is only required for the leaders of military organizations, but that political organizations don't need bravery. Gentlemen, political organizations manage everything in the end. They are the administrators of everything that's helped to create military ability over the past centuries. That's what they manage, and if they're cowardly, we'll let slip through our hands everything that's been won with the sword in the past. They can't be brave enough. On the contrary, bravery is especially necessary here because civil courage is something that's quite rare and must be especially cultivated.
Let me just point out that a little bit mm-hmm. earlier, he says that that the current state, the current National Socialist state, is the mm-hmm. perfection of the of German
yes.
history. So I think this is real important that he is trying to, in many other ways, to get across to these officers that this was not a mistake, you know, as some of them might want to think. This is the culmination of German history, and it's important that everybody understand that and get on board so that we'll be totally successful. And I think he was
correct.
Right. I mean, I believe he was right about that. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who didn't.
That's right. Those which we select from our youth today as descendants for the party must be of a kind so that the party will one day consist of our bravest people. That will be a solid leadership body. A soldier is the last person who ought to take offense at this, since that would be exactly as if I said, we're educating our entire German youth today in the love of their country and for the maintenance and defense of their country. So what do we need a military organization for? We don't need that. The thought of compulsory military service is shared by the whole German people anyway. Everybody has to fight. Yes, gentlemen, the military organization is the school of military exercise in the sense of training in weapons. If I take away this school, then the purely theoretical education is worth nothing. The movement in itself within the nation is the school and the leadership organization at the same time in the light of the recognition of these truths as I just very briefly attempted to show you. Because I'd like to stress one thing. If I were to summarize this revolution, which I'd like to call a revolution of reason to distinguish it from a revolution of madness, if I wished to summarize it in detail, then I'd naturally have to spend many, many hours on it. It would take 20 or 30 speeches because it, the revolution, affects almost all the problems of life and caused new positions to be taken in many fields. The obsolete traditions are like old household effects all piled up on top of each other and covered with dust. Thus, many things are no longer seen clearly.
He's taken out to some degree after tradition here, as well as what he was saying, old moral concepts earlier. That a lot of things that people thought had to be so, he's saying that we need to let a lot of that go so we can move forward into the future with a clear mind and not be full of guilt. It's going to come out, you know, that we don't need to feel guilty about anything we're doing. I'm just using the word guilt, but more like remorse or something. Like somehow we made a mistake, because he is trying to say there's no mistakes in where we stand today, and we need to move forward on it.
Well, that's a very good comment, and exactly right. And I'm remembering back to when we were discussing table talk, and I'm remembering the talks about these unmarried mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and how Hitler sprang to their defense. Yeah. And he talked about this guilt and this total focusing in on these young women who happen to be unfortunately single and pregnant. And how, hey, you know, this, in essence, he said, well, this should be forgiven and moved on and made the best of. And not condemnation.
Yeah.
He says, we have now taken up all this and deliberately incorporated them and worked through them in detail, and this work is going forward without interruption. We're not at the end of this revolution, but, so to say, only in the first year of this revolution. If I wanted to speak about it exactly, that would take an eternity. That's impossible. Finally, I would like to leave you with the impression that this is a gigantic phenomenon, out of and in light of which the gigantic transformation of the German people becomes understandable, including its readiness to subordinate itself to the current leadership, and with it to assume all the responsibilities with which the German people are burdened today. And that movements such as this are able to perform miracles is shown by history, over and over again. When the French revolutionary armies appeared to defend their revolutionary ideals, with which they inspired millions and millions of people with their Gallic verbosity, you could see that old, well-trained army unit simply collapsed because the revolutionary ideal had begun to split them up mentally, and partly because they were intellectually inferior. In 1805-06, Prussia finally collapsed, and then began in Prussia on the basis of the concept of fatherland, a dangerous concept in the dynastically divided age of that time because it already implied the concept of a great German state. Some of the advocates of this concept were sentenced to death a few years later, and some of them to imprisonment. But this concept remained so powerful, in spite of the poor training of so many of the soldiers, that in the end they fought in quite a different manner because they were inspired by an ideal. I must say that many of the ideas that somebody like Scharnhorst had in mind at that time could not be realized then. And only today and in today's armed forces are gradually and slowly finding their final fulfillment. So here as well, we are not doing something that arose suddenly as in a dream, but rather we are implementing the intellectual work that goes back generations. I myself do nothing other than to introduce discoveries in a closed form and implement them in practical politics or militarily. That is my activity. We've had two additional examples in recent times. Russia. Can you imagine monarchist Russian behaving like today's Bolsheviks? What a change brought about by a worldview. Now you shouldn't perhaps believe that I am illegible. A few days before the start of the Eastern campaign, I had a conversation with a Reichsmarschall. I said to him at that time, Goring, this will be our hardest struggle by far. And he said to me at that time, why do you believe, my Führer, that it will be so hard? I said, because for the first time, we'll be fighting an ideological enemy, and an ideological enemy of fantastic consistency. But Germany, too, is the proof of what such a spiritual conversion can do. And vice versa, the others which had not undergone the spiritual conversion are also proof of where you end up without it. So that in conclusion, I must say, the German officer must play the most intense part in this intellectual conversion. It really must be his creed, since he is, after all, the first one in our recent history in the happy position of being able to say that state representatives and the idea of the state are completely uniform. I only need to suggest a single idea, and then I'm working to preserve the state in an orientation which was not possible for generations before. And he can also say something else. I don't stand alone. But rather, I get all the youths born in one year after another delivered up with this education, and I have only this one job, continuing this upbringing. If I continue it, then I have a loyal, dedicated instrument in my hand. I know that because everybody who bears arms follows me just as exactly as they used to follow the political leadership and will continue to follow them. The soldier, the officer, is in the wonderful position of continuing an education which, in this Reich, begins particularly in childhood. Because even small children are raised this way in kindergarten. Later, the child enters the Jungvolk. He leaves the Jungvolk and enters the Hitler Youth. And there, once again, he's raised further in the same way. Then he leaves the Hitler Youth and enters a business and is once again educated in the same way. In the apprenticeship community, too, there's a uniform education. Then this same youth enters the party when he's 18. Again, the same education. Some of them enter the SA, also the same education, or the SS, also the same education. Then he enters the labor service, a continuation of this same education. Then he enters the military, and the same education must be continued here as well. And when the young man comes back from 2 years military service, he's led into the political movement, continuation of this education. Until the man is actually an old dotard, a uniform education from childhood onwards. Believe me, a body of the people that's been educated and molded like this can no longer be destroyed. Nobody can do a 1918 on it. It can thunder and storm all it wants, but you'll be able to rely on them to the end. Only one thing must never be permitted, an interruption somewhere in this educational process. And that is the big job of the whole German officer corps, fanatically, to carry out this wonderful task, to take its share of this uniform education on itself and continue it, while learning from it themselves without interruption. To remain at the level of the knowledge conveyed by scientific discoveries, passed to us by tradition, in order not only to maintain this youth which has been entrusted to them, but to strengthen them even further, and then, one day, to hand them over, so that the stream of German blood runs incessantly along the same course until they reach old age, and thus they remain free of inner decomposition and from all remorse.
Well, there he has that, saying that. If they're always taught the same thing, which is not approved of in supposedly democratic world, but, you know, when we look at the protocols of the wise elders of Zion, learned elders of Zion, one of their things is to keep everything in conflict, to keep a lot of conflicts going on, to have different opinions and lots of parties and so on. And this is what keeps our nations weak. So Hitler is here recognizing, and he's not apologizing for the fact that the people are being, in a sense, trained and brought into a way of thinking that they all share, and they don't even consider to think otherwise after a while. You know, this is just natural. Mm-hmm. And he says, when we do this and we have this all going on, we don't have to feel any remorse about it. We're taught all the right things. So that there's no openings there, as there are for us, in our societies, to feel, that same old guilty thing. But I want to go back to where he ties in his beginning when he talks about, when he says, finally, see, summing up, finally, I would like to leave you with the impression that this is a gigantic phenomenon, out of and in light of which the gigantic transformation of the German people becomes understandable. And he started out this talk way back when he said that the German people have undergone a gigantic or a huge transformation. Remember? in recent years. It took place in such a way that many are not even aware of it. They're not aware that they've undergone this transformation. That's just an example that impressed me, that he knows where he started this talk, and he's coming back into it at the end.
Oh, yeah. And you're bringing in that part about the protocols. Couldn't have been more perfect, Carolyn, because what those protocols were just one of the many examples of Jewish solidarity, and how, you know, they're telling you how minimally in numbers they are going to control the earth, so to speak, when things are said and done. And they have this inner philosophy themselves that nobody can crack. And what scared them so much was that Hitler was uniting the German people in the same kind of solidarity that was going to be unable to be cracked. And that's why they had to be crushed, by the rest of the world. And not only that, once they were beaten, they had to be eradicated in every way, shape, or form. That's how much they feared Adolf Hitler and his National Socialism.
Yeah, I agree with you now, and I agree with that more than ever after this, going over this talk one more time.
Hitler's trying to make his people to where they are no longer vulnerable to poison from the outside, meaning Jewish poison or from whatever angle, because they think as one, as a people, for the good of the whole people. And boy, that's one thing that the Jews do not want on the face of this earth, is another group that is just as united and solid as they are that looks out for its own interests.
Excellently put. You know, I was also thinking that in 1939, if Hitler had been able to work out the problems with Poland, then he probably would have been finished with his bringing all the ethnic Germans back into the Reich that were along the periphery of it. And I would say that the Jews knew that. They wanted this war. They wanted a war. And they thought, well, if they didn't get the war going now, there might not have been a war, because if Hitler had succeeded in making the deal with Poland, then he may have set and everything would have gone along all right, and there would have been no reason. So I think that the Jews, that's why they got going so much at that time in 1939, to make sure that nothing worked out and to push the nations into war. And that's how it happened. And that really does make it that it's the Jews who are behind all this. And the Jews were so powerful in Britain, but the British people were not interested in this. And even a lot of the British leaders were not. And the real king wasn't interested in it. But all of this was, all these machinations were going on. And they managed to do it. And that was really the beginning of the end right there. Hitler had no choice but to do all the things that he did from that point on. And the whole time he didn't really have any choices. He did the right thing. And he's trying to get these officers to understand that the Reich that he has built up is something worth fighting for, and that it's truly German. It's not something foreign that so many wanted to say, well, we're going in the wrong direction here. We don't want to continue along this course. That was his great effort. I think he made a tremendous effort here to win over as many of these officers who were still causing problems. Well, did I already say that in just a couple months later was the assassination attempt? And that's when the whole thing blew open.
Right.
I guess I said that already.
You know, you brought out so much very good, honest, and correct history in what you just said about the Jewish manipulations. And you were quite correct in saying the British people really wanted no part of this, and a huge section of the British leadership didn't want it. But the Jews were at the time trying to build a fire under Chamberlain, when he kept trying to hold back and trying to delay this thought of war, and then they just kicked his butt out and replaced him with their pimp, Winston Churchill, and that cinched everything.
Yeah.
I mean, Chamberlain had to give in here and there, but he did not want a war at all. He knew that it was going to destroy Europe. So, and the big winner would be the USSR. But anyway, Hitler goes on to say, "We're doing the people the greatest service with all this, because, believe me, this mass wants to be led. The same way as it depends on its company commander and is happy when they get a company commander who knows how to lead them, and happy when they aren't wrongly led." Illegible. Small community of 80, 100, 150 men in the same way. "The German people are happy when it's presented with a uniform leadership, which leads and spares them from all future conflicts.
I thought this was very, very interesting. And these are some ideas that I really weren't formed in my mind at all, because we grow up with so many ideas that if your leadership is too strong, then it, you know, you're not giving the people enough choices. But he's saying that the people want this kind of leadership. They're happy when they're presented with a good, strong leadership, and they want to go along with it. And, you know, I think he's absolutely 100% true, and that's why we're so unhappy today, because we have too much pressures put upon us. We feel like we're supposed to decide. We're supposed to work it out, what's going to happen and how to improve things or what to do, and we really can't do it. And the vast majority of people don't have any ideas about it whatsoever.
That's right. Just for a mere reflection of the United States, just look at Weimar Germany. Like Hitler said when he tried to go into Parliament and observe, he said, you talk about a cacophony of circus clowns and nothing got done, and it was pathetic.
Yeah, and then he also points out, and he's often made this point, that people know good leaders. Whether it's school children with their teachers or whether it's soldiers with their commanders and so on, they know when a leader knows what he's doing and whether he's worth following or not. So that's one thing they do know. They can recognize whether they have faith in someone to let them lead them. And that's all they need to know, because the leaders will show up. If all you have are bad leaders, you don't have any good ones, they're not allowed, then you're up a creek, really. And people are just generally unhappy and grumbling and saying that nothing is any good.
That's right.
And that leads them to revolution, right? I mean, that's the kind of grumbling that goes on that eats away at a strong state. Sorry. Mm-hmm. What were you going to say?
Very true. Well, I was just going to say, all of your comments are answered. I mean, what you said what's in this next paragraph quite well. Hitler goes on to say, the people can't decide all that, believe me. People have often said to me, why not let the people decide such a thing? I always made the decision myself and only asked the people, do you agree with the decision? And they always approved it. But I mustn't expect the people themselves to make the decision. If the leadership lacks the courage to make a decision, should I expect the little people to reach a uniform decision? If the big intellectuals aren't agreed on something, then somebody has to make a decision. That is also what's wonderful about the career of an officer. It's quite natural. I can't leave it to the company, I can't leave it to the battalion, or to a subaltern to decide what sort of decision should be made. And the more critical the decision, the prouder an individual officer should be to take the responsibility upon himself, even with the danger of acting wrongly once in a while. And that's not important. It's better to have acted wrongly once, since the masses must never get the feeling that it depends on them, or that the decision lies with them. That would be equivalent to a declaration of waiver of leadership and a declaration of cowardice on the part of the leadership. That must not be.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic that he says the masses must never get the feeling that it depends on them.
That's right.
There you go.
Because they know they aren't capable of toting the load, despite what a lot of them will say. Anyway, he goes on to say, I am so deeply convinced of this. It's my rock solid conviction that precisely this war will increasingly intensify National Socialist feeling in the German armed forces, that when this war is over, we will have won it through this new worldview, and that we all have only one goal. To be increasingly more active in the formation of the body of our people, to harden it more and more until our people are formed into an indestructible block which can then fulfill its mission in Europe, a mission it's been given. Since there can be no doubt as to one thing, either we lose this war, that will be the end of our people, or we win, and that will be the case. And that will be the beginning of our rule over Europe. Sustained lengthy applause.
Hitler's vision, not in 1925, but probably formed during the late 1930s, was that the Germans were destined to rule a new Europe. He started out in 1918 with a defeated and desolated Germany and totally demoralized. And so he still sees that in order for Germany to survive as a German nation, it has to be like this. It can't afford to just have all this freedom or all this democracy, because he saw what that brought. That brings the Jews in. The Jews take control then. And he saw that the Jews were the problem. Mm-hmm. So this is the state that he has built up and says it can be even better and stronger. But these are the things that we have to accept about it. We have to accept that we don't make the decisions. And we have to accept that we trust our leadership. We have to do our part. And
sure.
But it was a happy place, as you pointed out before. So we'll see. Well, we're not done yet. I'm sorry.
Right. Well, it's all right. Your comments were quite necessary and pertinent. This closes with an address by Reichsmarshal Göring. My Führer, gentlemen, in this hour, we have had a tremendous inner experience, and you, gentlemen, have been given a deep insight through the Führer into the whole essence of National Socialism and what it is and what it wants. I can act as interpreter here better than anyone else, since I, too, like you, we were all educated as officers' candidates, as cadets, and we've all been through this education. We all went through it. I became a National Socialist very early. I thank my Creator. I was able to throw off my baggage early, baggage which many of you gentlemen have had to carry much longer and into recent years, right down to today. You would experience a great feeling of relief if you could throw off all this old rubbish from yesteryear, which prevents us from seeing clearly in many areas, and enter the new and beautiful all the more easily. We must be clear in our own minds, precisely we officers, that it is our duty in the future, as the Führer just said, to educate and form new officers. We must be clear in our own minds that what was once perhaps correct can no longer be correct today in this state and above all in this people. We must also find our way to these new ideas, and gentlemen, we wish to say once openly, and it means a lot to me to say, when we were being educated as cadets or young lieutenants, the monarchy still existed, and as the Führer correctly said, it was a matter of course for the entire officer corps to be monarchists, and it was quite natural for the officer corps to stand and live for its monarch. For us, that was something completely natural. Nobody thought about it and dared to criticize it. Everybody took the top warlords as he found them and felt bound to do so. And there I ask you now, gentlemen, how much happier and prouder can we be that duty assigns us in this hour to serve our Commander-in-Chief, a man whose coming to be we ourselves have seen, who in these years did so many incredibly difficult things and had to endure so much. I believe there is no prouder feeling for an officer than in this hour to crowd around this man and experience the happy feeling to stand by his side to the last. From our innermost hearts, long live our Führer for all time. Heil, heil, heil. Enthusiastic applause and renewed stormy demonstrations of applause for the Führer. And that's it.
There you go. Reichsmarshal Göring pretty much summed up what this speech was,
yes,
was intended to do. He either understood it ahead of time or he picked it up as Hitler was speaking. And he understood it perfectly well. And he said it. We need to stand behind our leader and carry on. And that's what they hoped would happen. But there was a bunch of rotten apples in there.
That's right. And you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you your personal opinion on this. It's very ironic that it's 2 months later the assassination attempt occurred. And I thought, after I read both these sections, was there a feeling amongst maybe the Führer, Göring, that maybe perhaps some rumors had started about some high-level dissent among the German high command or whatever, that they were beginning to kind of doubt or whatever? So
the answer to that is that he always knew. He had this feeling that they weren't being truthful with him. And then he also knew that his orders weren't being followed. And they would give these excuses. They were pretty clever. they would give excuses that he couldn't really find fault with, or he couldn't fire them over it. He didn't want to fire all these people anyway because he didn't have replacements for them. And he thought he didn't want to fire the top generals and field marshals unless he was absolutely necessary.
Sure.
So then, he's trying, they were always working on it, but they couldn't pin it down. I think that the reason that he gave this talk was that it was May 26, 1944. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always a spring offensive, and maybe some of them had already taken place. But they're into a final push. He had some plans, some offensives, both on both fronts. They needed to have a victory. They needed to make some progress. And so he probably was making an attempt to encourage them to do their best. That's what I would say. So I know critics say that this speech at this time was too late. It was too late. And maybe it was too late, but he still put forth what he could, hoping that it wasn't too late, I suppose. It wasn't too late to turn things around. In any case, yeah. He gives us a lot of insight into his thinking, and he says a lot of great things.
Oh, absolutely. The content was really, really powerful. You know, I enjoyed the fact that we got to discuss this and hope someone got some benefit out of what it was about. It was very, very beneficial to read. And I think Hitler was right in giving that talk. You know, I find no criticism whatsoever of it.
There we go. Whoops. We're losing our connection. Let's see here. We did get cut off, listeners, and Ray Goodwin went offline. Thunderstorms were taking place in his neck of the woods, but luckily we had finished, so I will bring this program to a close by thanking Ray for his participation and thanking you for listening. I hope you gained a better feel for what Adolf Hitler was all about, and I really hope that some false impressions and wrong ideas that you may have gotten from others have been corrected in your mind. This is Carolyn Yeager signing off for The Heretics Hour on June 14th, 2015. See you next time.